Well, you know, Bill wasn't the people in the high places. He tried to sell him this idea, and he said, "I'll go out and do this if y'all give me the money to do it with." And they didn't think it was something they needed to do. You know, you couldn't imagine that today they wouldn't do that. But so Bill said, "You know how Bill, you know how alcoholic gets the idea." He said, "Well, if you won't do it, I'll do it myself. I just do it myself. It's my idea." So he and Lois, he quits his position. He and Lois get a motorcycle, you know, a tent and sidecar and all that stuff stuffed in, and they go off to do this on his own. He says, "You know, we gave up our positions and off we rode on a motorcycle, sidecar stuff with a tent, blankets, change of clothes, and three huge volumes of financial reference services. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. We had some success at speculation, so we had a little money. We once worked on a farm for a month before drawing on our small capital." And they really had a tough time doing this. And Bill traveled from this area all the way down the Atlantic coast, all the way down into the south, clean back up through Kentucky, and come on back up through Pennsylvania. And he said that he investigated 100 of the largest corporations in America on his own, sending these reports back to Wall Street. This was quite a thing and quite an accomplishment. He said, "That was the last manual labor on my part for many days. We covered the whole eastern United States in a year. It took a year. At the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account. The exercise of the option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of $7,000 for that year." So after he did this, it started to pay out. He says, "For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way, I had arrived." You know, this guy really finally got there. His idea worked. He said, "My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important, exhilarating part in my life. There was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everybody spending thousands and shouting millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair-weather friends." So Bill becomes successful with this little venture. And he looked up, people listened to him to make investments. And here he is now. You remember, he come here from East Dorset, right? And all he wants is in New York, right? And he's on Wall Street, and people are listening to him, and he's giving them advice about how to make money. You know, man, that's a long way from where he started.
He became the fair-haired boy on Wall Street.
Yeah.
I can just see him there, you know, and he's got a good job now. He's got a good expense account. He's exercised an option and brought in several thousand dollars. He's drinking and he's having fun, and life is really, really exciting for him. He's on top of the heap. I don't have any trouble identifying with Bill Wilson. How many of us have done the same thing? And that great, great feeling when we get there. But we know as an alcoholic now, his drinking is going to get worse. He said, "My drinking assumed more serious proportions. He drank for excitement for a long time. Now it's getting to be pretty serious business. Continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. People begin to say to Bill, 'Bill, you're drinking too much. Bill, why don't you cut back? Bill, you're costing us money. Bill, why don't you quit?' And Bill did the same thing so many of us did. He said, 'To hell with them. Who needs them anyhow?' And rather than quit his drinking, he begins to operate now on his own. He said there were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There'd been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of those scrapes." Now, I've always believed everything Bill wrote, but I'm not sure about that last statement. Lois, in some of her writings, has a little bit different idea about that, you know. We were at the cemetery today, and I stood there and looked at Lois's grave, and I said, if only you could tell us the real truth, you know. Page 4. abruptly in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed, the ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of the tape which bore the inscription XYC32. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were many friends. The papers reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance. Well, that disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. Bill had a solution to that problem. He said, "My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock, so what? Tomorrow was another day," and as I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. How many of us have done the same thing? We come out of the hospitals, the divorce courts, the jailhouses, low, sad, depressed, stopped off in a bar, have a couple of drinks, and as the alcohol courses through our veins, we say, "We'll show them. They're not going to treat us that way." And we're off and we're running again. Always that fierce determination to win, to show them that we're just as good as they are. He said, "Next morning I telephoned a friend in Montreal. He had plenty of money left and thought I'd better go to Canada. By the following spring, we were living in our custom style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No San Helena for me. But drinking caught up with me again. And my generous friend had to let me go, and this time we stayed broke. Now we see a guy that his drinking has progressed to the point where he can no longer hold a job. We went to live with my wife's parents. I found a job, then lost it as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver. Mercifully, no one could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places. Now, here was a guy that just not too long before this, he was the fair-haired boy on Wall Street. His judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. Now then, he's down to the point where he no longer can even hold a job. His wife has had to go to work. He goes into the brokerage places, and they say, 'Bill, we'd really rather you didn't come in. Bill, why don't you just go on down the street?' This has got to be quite a come down for a guy like Bill Wilson. I have no trouble identifying with Bill. Now then, we're getting a drink for another cause. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. Now we're drinking because we absolutely have to. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often 3, got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s, and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin, followed by 6 bottles of beer, would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. Remember, Dr. Silkworth said we really cannot differentiate the true from the false. To us, what we're doing is normal. And we see Bill's life going to hell in a handbasket already. Bill can't see that. He thinks he can still control the situation. The complete inability to see the truth about our lives. Gradually, things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at the low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and that chance vanished. This is a story within itself. The guys that had the money, they knew what Bill could do. He was good at what he did. And they went to Bill and they said, "Bill, we've got another deal for you. And we think we can make ourselves some money, and you can too, providing you stay sober. Are you agreeable?" And Bill said, "Oh yeah, man, don't worry about that drinking. I'm through with that drinking. Let's get on with it." And they began to put this deal together, and they turned it over to Bill. And he worked at it for a matter of months, stayed sober all that time. And just a night or two before it was to be completed, they're all sitting around in a hotel room, and somebody passed around a bottle of Applejack. And it went by Bill, and he said, "No, thank you, I'm not drinking." And after a while, it made the rounds and came back, and the guy next to him said, "Bill, don't you understand that this Applejack is the finest Applejack in the world? This is called Jersey lightning. You've never seen anything like this before. And Bill's mind said, I've never tasted any Jersey lightning. And with no more thought than that, he reached out and got the bottle, took a drink, triggered the allergy, and blew the whole deal. Now the importance in that lies within the next statement. For the first time, Bill could differentiate the truth from the false. He said, I woke up, this had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I'd written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Now that Bill could see what alcohol was really doing to him, he finally said to himself, I'll never be able to drink anymore. I'm through with it. I'm going to quit. He trotted out his willpower. Now, Bill had a tremendous amount of willpower. Self-made man. Everything he had ever done, he had done on his own. And he knew that all he had to do was exercise his willpower, and he'd be able to live without drinking. You know, they try to tell we alcoholics we are weak-willed people. Don't you believe that. We're not weak-willed people. We're strong-willed people. Weak-willed people never become alcoholic. The third time they vomit, they quit drinking. Alcoholic knows there's got to be a way to drink without puking. We damn near kill ourselves. We are strong-willed people. Now let's see the results of quitting on his own willpower.
Just shortly after, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. And then he begins to say, was I crazy?
Since willpower won't work,
I must be
then
crazy.
He begins to question his sanity and begins to think maybe he really is crazy.
I begin to, for such appalling lack of perspective, seem near being that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some passed, the confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills, I have what it takes. One day I walked in a cafe to telephone, and in no time I was beaten on a bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I'd manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did.
How many of us have done the same thing? The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably. There was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I hardly dared cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. An all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My writhing nerves were still at last. The morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Now we're beginning to question not only our sanity, we're beginning to think about suicide now. Then a mental fog would settle down. Gin would fix that. So two bottles and oblivion. Now we're drinking for the sickest reason of all. We can't face life without alcohol, and we can't face life with alcohol. And we think we're crazy. We begin to think about committing suicide. Life is becoming so unbearable we just can't stand it. So we now drink for absolute, complete oblivion, just to get out of the picture. And the only thing wrong with drinking for oblivion, the next morning you wake up and the whole mess is still there, and you got to start it all over again. I have no trouble identifying with Bill Wilson. Joe?
The mind and the body are marvelous mechanisms. For mine endured this agony 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's in the purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or a medicine cabinet, where there was poison, cursing myself for I weakened. There were flights from city to country and back, as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night, then the physical and mental torture was so hellish, I feared I would burst through my window sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor, suddenly thus I leaped. A doctor came with heavy sedatives. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedatives. this combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity, so did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight.
Now we see a guy who's actually dying. You know, he can't eat anymore. And all the calories he's getting are those empty calories out of the alcohol itself. Mm-hmm. He's dying with malnutrition. You know, people like us, we get all bloated up and we look about half healthy, but we're really dying from malnutrition because we're not eating the right kind of foods. We're drinking that old booze. We're getting those empty calories. Bill was a lucky man. If it hadn't been for his brother-in-law, he wouldn't be with us. Mm-hmm. He said, my brother-in-law is a physician. This is Dr. Leonard Strong, married to Bill's sister. And through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. This is the town's hospital in New York City, mm-hmm. with Dr. Silkworth. Under the so-called Belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Belladonna was a drug that was a member of the nightshade family, and they used it to fool the body into thinking it had alcohol in it. It was used for withdrawal purposes. Today they use Valium for that purpose. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise help much.
Hydrotherapy, hydro means water. And that was simply they put you in a room in a gurney, and they had a lot of hot showers and cold showers that would shoot down on the gurney. They would hit you with hot water and cold water. That was hydrotherapy. It won't cure alcoholism, but you get a clean drunk out of it.
We saw a place in Australia that was still using this, and they rolled one of those old boys out of there after about an hour, and his old skin was so wrinkled up you couldn't hardly even tell he was human. He'd been in there having hydrotherapy. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill, bodily and mentally.
Yeah.
Now, this is after Silky withdrew Bill. He sits down and explains to him the physical allergy and the obsession of the mind.
Yeah.
And Bill said, it relieved me somewhat to learn that an alcoholic's the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. When Dr. Silkworth told him about the obsession of the mind, it explained to Bill why willpower wouldn't work.
Yeah.
My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself, I fared forth in high hope, and I can almost see Bill. He knows what his problem is now. He knows why willpower won't work. And he says, you know, I'm not crazy. I'm really a sick person.
Mm-hmm.
I have no trouble identifying with Bill Wilson. You know, when I got here, I thought my problem was crazy. When I got here, I'd thought about committing suicide for a long time. And I was relieved to find out that I was an alcoholic and what an alcoholic really is. You know, it relieved me to find out that the reason I couldn't drink anymore is because of the allergy, and the reason I couldn't stay sober is because of the obsession. He said, for 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer. Self-knowledge. Let's see where he went on self-knowledge.
Well, it was not. But a frightful day came when I drank once more.
Now, the first trip was the summer of 1933. Now we've been drinking again for about another year. And we're going back to the towns now in the summer of 1934.
The curve of my decline. Moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital. Now he's back to the towns in 1934. This was a finish of curtains, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that with all in and heart failures and her delirium tremors, I would develop a wet brain perhaps within a year. She would have to give me over to the undertaker on the asylum. And this is the trip Bill overheard Dr. Silkworth telling Lois how serious his condition was. He said, they did not need to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. It was a devastating blow to my pride, this guy that had all this pride. I who thought so well of myself and my abilities and my abilities of my capacities surmount obstacles as current it lasts. After doing all that stuff on Wall Street, he knew he had a lot of ability and he had a lot of willpower. But with all that, he was cornered at last. He said, I was to plunge in the dark, joining the endless procession of sights who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. What would I not give to make amends? But that was over now. Now, let's look real closely at this next paragraph. I've read a lot of Bill's work. I think it's the most, but really I think this is the most beautiful expression of step one that I've ever read. It says, no words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. This is where Bill admitted, it wasn't any step one written for me in those days, but here's where Bill surely admitted total defeat. He admitted that he was powerless over alcohol and that his life had become totally unmanageable.
I've never seen a better description of step one than what Joe just read. Now, if that should happen to you and I today, well, we would probably say, well, that being the case, I guess I better go to AA. But Bill didn't have any AA to go to. He's in the best facility that he knows of at that time. And even though he knows the problem, and even though he's admitted complete defeat, the only thing he can do is leave that hospital and try to stay sober. He said, trembling, I stepped from the hospital a broken man. Fear sobered me for a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink. And on Armistice Day 1934, I was off again. Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted in what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. I wish no happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. Near the end of that bleak November, and I imagine it was pretty bleak, he started drinking on November the 11th. We're getting close to the end of it now. He's been drunk well over 2 weeks. I sat drinking in my kitchen. With a certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of her bed. I would need it before daylight. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. Now this, of course, is Ebbie Thatcher. He was sober. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. And like John said this afternoon, the last thing Bill heard about Ebbie is Ebbie was to be taken in front of a judge, and the judge was going to commit him to the state insane asylum here in the state of Vermont for what they called alcoholic insanity. That's what they used to do with people like us. And just about anybody could do that for you. Members of your family, members of the law enforcement agencies, or any interested friend could do that for you. We were pretty well fair game. And John told the story about Ebbie shooting the pigeons off the roof. The other thing he didn't tell was Ebbie got out his father's old car up over here in Manchester, and he went out one day driving around, drinking a little, and he came home and he missed the driveway. And he ran into the driveway of the neighbor and ended up going into the side of the neighbor's house. In fact, the car went all the way in the house, ended up in the kitchen. And the lady of the house was standing in the kitchen when the car came in. And Ebbie got out and doffed his hat, said, good morning, madam. 'Twould be a fine morning for a cup of coffee, would it not? And some narrow-minded judge with no sense of humor is about to put old Ebbie in the nut house. That's the last Bill had heard about him. But here he is in New York City. He's not in the nut house, and he's also sober. Bill said, I wondered how he had escaped. Of course, he would have dinner that I could eat openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility, the very thing an oasis drinkers are like that. The door opened and he stood there fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table and he refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what got into the fellow. He wasn't himself. "Come, what's all this about?" I queried. And he looked straight at me. Simply but smilingly, he said, "I've got religion." Man, I'm glad that didn't happen in my kitchen. I have no idea what I would have done. You know, I'm sure I would have blown my stack completely. But here's what Bill did. He said, "I was aghast." So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspect a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yeah, the old boy was on fire, all right. But bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court, persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea.
Step 2.
And a practical program of action.
Steps 3 through 12.
That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. This really impressed Bill, because he knew about Ebby, and he knew how Ebby drank. And he always said, "If I ever get as bad as Ebby Thatcher, I'm going to quit drinking." And here's Ebby sitting in his kitchen, sober. And he said, "Bill, I have found a way to live without drinking alcohol." And he told about this simple religious idea, this need for the vital spiritual experience.
Right.
And he told about the practical program of action. And he said, "Bill, I've come to give this to you too." Now, even though Bill was impressed by this, we're going to see in the next couple of pages that Bill just simply did not like this idea at all. We saw him take step one.
Yeah.
Let's see him now get himself ready to take step two. Let's see how this comes about.
Okay. He talked over on page 10. He talked for hours. And this is a conversation, Ebby and Bill, in Bill's kitchen. Now remember now, Bill is drinking and Ebby's sober. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was a prophet temperance pledge I never signed. My grandfather's good-natured temples from church folks and their doings. His insistence that the spirits really had their music, but his denial that preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. His fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections well from the past, and they made me swallow hard. You know, this is really special, sitting here tonight listening to this and reliving it all and being right close to it. It's very moving. And Bill, as his childhood, he grew up here, and then he was 12 years old, he moved over to Grandpa Griffith's house down the street. Grandpa Griffith had a lot of great influence on Bill. It seemed like that he was a person in this little community that really had nothing to do with the church. He didn't have a problem with God, but he had the problem with the church of that day. And he influenced Bill along these lines. Bill had grew up with this and had been influenced by it. When Ebby come to Bill, remember, Ebby was not coming to him with the God as we understand him of Alcoholics Anonymous. That hadn't started yet. He came to him with the God, the program of the Oxford Groups. And the Oxford Groups contain a lot, all religious expressions, sin, and those type of expressions that related to the church, and Bill resisted to this. And Bill did not like Ebby's conversation. This was quite a conversation. Ebby said later it didn't really come out like Bill wrote it in the story, because he said he was sober. He ought to know Bill wasn't.
He said, "I was the only one there that day sober. I ought to know what was right."
But Bill listened to this, and Bill says, you know, he listened to Ebby, and he said, "I've always believed in a power greater than myself." He didn't have any problem with God. "I had often pondered these things." He said, "I was not an atheist. Few people really are, and that means faith in a strange proposition that the universe originates in a cipher and aimlessly rushes nowhere." He said, "My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomer, and even the evolutionists suggest vast laws and forces at work. I knew some force run this world. But despite contrary indication, I had little doubt there was a mighty purpose and rhythm underlying all. How could there be such a precise, immutable law with no intelligence? I simply had to believe in the spirit of the universe who knew neither time or limitation. But that was far as I had gone." He said, "With ministers and the world's religion," Bill, this was Bill's objection, not just to God, but to the religion.
And he got this from his grandfather.
Yeah. I parted right there. He said, when he talked of a God personal to me, who was love, superhuman strength, and directions, I became irritated. My mind stepped shut against such a theory. He said, "To Christ I concede his certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him." And I love the way he puts this.
I don't have any trouble identifying with Bill Wilson.
"His moral teaching most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those points which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded." I can identify with that.
He said, "The wars which had been fought, the burnings and chicanery that religious dispute had facilitated, made me sick. I honestly doubted whether, on balance, the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging from what I'd seen in Europe and since, the power of God in human affairs was negligible, the brotherhood of man a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal, and he certainly had me." God, I could just see these guys. Ebby sober, Bill drunk. We're talking about God. And Bill said, "Man, don't give me that stuff." He said, "Don't talk to me about a God that's kind. Look at all the things that's going on in the world. Do you mean to tell me that God allowed? Don't give me that jazz." And then he said, "But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he'd admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he'd ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There'd been no more power in him than there was in me at that minute, and this was none at all. This is where the identification process is so important." Bill knew about Ebby. And he knew how Ebby drank. And he knew that if Ebby was staying sober, and if he had been sober 2 months, some power greater than Ebby had to be working in Ebby's life. Now, whether Bill likes it or not is absolutely beside the point. Ebby is sitting there as living proof. And you know, that's the thing you and I have to offer to a newcomer today. We're sitting there talking to that newcomer, and we're offering that newcomer living proof that some power has worked within our lives too. And if that newcomer has identified with us through our drinking and through our obsession and through our, then he begins to say, "Well, just maybe, you know, just maybe, if that guy, the power worked for him, just it might just work for me." And that's what Ebby was showing to Bill. Now, Bill still doesn't like it though. Page 12, first paragraph. "Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. Even though he could see that in Ebby, he still didn't like it. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When a thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. I see these guys sitting there, and what they're doing, really, they're arguing about God. You know how we alcoholics are when it comes to God, especially if one of us is drunk. And they're sitting there arguing about who God is and who He isn't, whether He's a personal God or a loving God or the devil or the universal mind. And I guess Ebby finally got sick of that stuff. And finally he said, and in the next statement, he opened the door not only for Bill Wilson, but he opened the door for countless millions of we alcoholics. My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, and if you'll notice, this is in squiggly writing, it's got to be important. He said, well, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And the instant he said that, his message changed from a religious message to a spiritual message. You see, religion says this is the way you have to believe. And spirituality says it really doesn't make any difference how you believe or you're willing to believe. So we're no longer talking about religion now. We're talking about spirituality. And what this did to Bill, it took all argument away from him. When he's now allowed to choose his own conception, I think probably in effect, Ebby said, Bill, what the hell are we arguing about? What difference does it make whether we call him God, universal mind, spirit of nature, Yahweh? Why don't you just choose your own conception of God? Now here's the effect it had on Bill. That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain whose shadow I'd lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required to me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. And this is where Bill took step two. No step two written in those days. But through this little statement, why don't you choose your own conception of God, Bill can now begin to believe that there is a power greater than he is that could restore him to sanity. And if you'll notice also, he said, upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Now, this is going to be Bill's first reference to a wonderfully effective spiritual structure. And as we progress through the book, he's going to paint a picture in our mind using words. And after a while, he's going to tell us what that structure is, and he's going to tell us that we will pass through it to freedom. And the beginning of that structure is the foundation of it. Willingness is the foundation. Willingness comes from step one. When we can see that what we're trying to do on our own is no longer going to work, when we can freely, completely admit that we're powerless over alcohol, when we can concede to our innermost selves that we're alcoholics, then we become willing to try something different. That comes through step one. The foundation of this whole structure will be step one, willingness. Now later on we're going to see where believing is the cornerstone, but willingness is the foundation. And as we progress through the book, he'll put more stone, beautiful, beautiful way to write. And he'll paint this picture in our mind as we go through. Now Bill has now taken steps one and step two. No, they were not written in those days, but we could see Bill take them. Now, Ebby begins to take Bill to Oxford group meetings. But remember, Bill's drinking. The allergies got him, and he can't stop. Finally, he had to be put back in the town's hospital for the third trip on page 13. He said, at the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. Now, after he's withdrawn from alcohol by Silkworth again, Ebby comes to visit with him. They begin to apply the little Oxford group program in Bill's life to the best of their ability. Let's see if we can't see on page 13 the last 10 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous.
He said, there I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly on his care and directions. I admitted for the first time of myself I was nothing. Without him, I was lost.
We see Bill taking that first tenet or step that they had, which was called surrender. Later he changed it to step three, where we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand him. We see Bill taking step three there in the town's hospital.
I ruthlessly face my sins.
Their next step that they had was examine your sins. And later on, Bill knew no self-respecting alcoholic's going to do that. So he changed that to made a searching and fearless moral inventory. He's now taking step four, I ruthlessly face my sins.
And became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. I had not had a drink since.
Became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. That statement later became step six and seven. We became willing to have God remove these defects of character and humbly ask him to do so. Another thing you'll notice, when he said newfound friend, you'll notice there the word friend is capitalized. Bill uses many, many different names in the big book for God. But every time he does, he capitalizes that name, whatever it is. Here he's referring to his newfound friend, or God, to take away these character defects.
My schoolmate visited him, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies.
My schoolmate visited me, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. He's now taking what we know today as step five, with Ebby, there in the town's hospital.
We made a list of people I had hurt and to whom I felt resentments. I expressed my willingness to approach these individuals admitting my wrongs. Never I'd be the critical of them. I was to write all such matters to the utmost of my ability.
Now we see him dealing with steps eight and nine, where we make the list, become willing, and then start making the amends.
I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense.
That statement later became step 10, where we continued to take personal inventory.
I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for directions and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never were I to pray for myself except as my request bore my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, and that would be in great measures.
Surely there we see all the parts of step 11, where we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. He's now dealing with step 11.
My friend promised, when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, and I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems.
It's got to be the first part, step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, now he says, belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things, were the essential requirements. Simple, but not easy. The price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light who presides over us all. Poor old alcoholic, in order for us to recover, we have to give up the two things we hold nearest and dearest to our heart. Number one is alcohol, and number two is self-centeredness. Very simple idea, but extremely difficult to do. You'll notice here, he referred to God as the Father of Light this time, capitalizing these words. He said these were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I'd never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. You go up here on this mountain, and you go back into those quarries, and the way they're cut back into there, and the wind will blow, and it just whistles through those things. And we were standing up there one day, and that wind came through there, and I said, Joe, there's where the statement came from. The great clean wind of the mountaintop blew through and through. Came from right here. He said, for a moment I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor to ask if I were still sane. Bill thought he was going crazy. He listened in wonder as I talked. And finally he shook his head saying, something has happened to you, I don't understand. but you'd better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were. Now, we don't know what happened to Bill that day. We were not there to see that. But we do know this was probably about December the 12th of 1934. And we do know that Bill didn't die until January of 1971. And he never had to take another drink as long as he lived. He always said that he had in the town's hospital a vital spiritual experience as the result of these steps, during which old ideas were cast aside and replaced with a completely new set of ideas. And one of the new ideas is down here a little further. He said, "While I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They in turn might work with others. My friend," and this time it's a little F, we're referring to Ebby now. "My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead," he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. "For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. And if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. And with us, it is just like that." And remember, Bill left that hospital, started trying to help alcoholics, helped nobody for 6 months. Then when he was in Akron about to get drunk, he remembered how back in New York, even though he'd never helped anybody, he himself had felt better. So he called Dr. Bob, not to sober up Bob, but to keep old Bill from getting drunk. Thank God he did it. If he hadn't have done it, we probably wouldn't be here today. And I think you and I need to remember this too, that we can have all the faith in the world we want, but unless we put that faith to work through trying to help others, then surely we're going to lose it too, just like Bill was about to lose it. And if we, every time we do that, we ourselves feel better too. Now, if we're a brand new alcoholic and we're out in the state of California and we've never had any contact with this fellowship except this book, and if we've been able to read the doctor's opinion and we've been able to read Bill's story and we've been able to identify with Bill, for the first time we can see what our problem is. And for the first time we can see another human being who's just like us, who has overcome that problem. And probably for the first time we begin to think that I'm enough like this guy that if he could recover from that condition, just maybe I could too. The beginning of belief, the beginning of hope. And we could hardly wait to see what is it this guy had to do to recover from this condition. And I don't think it's any accident that the very next chapter says there is a solution. And we're going to see in the very next chapter exactly what Bill did to recover and how it came about. And in this chapter, it's going to talk about two powers. You know, our problem is we're powerless. So if the problem is powerless, then the solution must lie within power. And here we're going to talk about the power of the fellowship, and we're going to talk about the power of the common solution. And if we can hit the power of the fellowship and the power of the common solution added together in our lives, then that should be enough power to overcome our powerlessness over alcohol. And the first thing he's going to talk about is the power of the fellowship.
Chapter 2, there is a solution, page 17. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. He says, "We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds."
Today we could say we're average citizens of the world.
That's right.
Last count I had, we were in 144 different countries. So we're average citizens of the world today.
He describes the fellowship, "We are average citizens of the world," as Charlie says, "Americans at that time." The book has been all sections of the country, all sections of the world are represented, And then our fellowship, he's describing the fellowship. What is it made up of? We have a lot of different occupations. You know, we have all types of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. It amazes me about our fellowship, having seen so much of it all over the world and had the opportunity to see. You know, it's unbelievable the type of, we have all kinds of people in our fellowship. We have all kind of different occupations. We have many different
political backgrounds,
different economic backgrounds, different social backgrounds, different religious backgrounds, and different races, and different, it's different. You know, in fact, this group in here now is probably one of the most, I know it's the most mixed up group in East Dorset.
Probably in the whole state of Vermont.
Yeah. It's a whole mixture here. Usually when people come together, any group of people, even a family, when people come together, they have something in common that brings them together. In a family, it's a common bloodline. In a church, it'd be a common belief. In a union, it'd be a common cause. Something brings people together, usually when they're in a group, something that they have something in common that brings them together. And in this group here tonight, we have none of the things that usually bring people together. We come from different religions, different social backgrounds, different economic backgrounds. It's the most mixed up group of people you've ever seen right here tonight. See, if we didn't talk about alcoholism tonight, the big book, if we took that out of our midst and said we can't discuss that no more this weekend, I doubt if we could. I wonder what we would talk about. We couldn't talk about our work. We talk about politics, we'd have a fight. We talk about religion, we'd get in an argument. We wouldn't talk, we don't identify on none of those things. He said, we are people who normally would not mix. None of us should have ever come together with the other one. We should have never known each other. We should have lived our lives out on the face of this earth and never known each other. But he says, but there exists among us, as strangers, a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We're very, very close, although we should have never come together. And then he uses the illustration. I love the way he teaches. You know, it's a great shortcut way of teaching is using an illustration. We had another teacher 2,000 years ago that would use parables to teach. And Bill likes to use the illustrations to teach. He says, the fellowship, we are like the passengers on a great liner. The moment after rescue from the shipwreck, when camaraderie, joy, and democracy pervade the vessel from the stairs to the captain's table. This was a great illustration at the time the book was written in the 30s. People are still traveling to Europe on ocean liners. We have airplanes today. But on the great ocean liners, people were separated on those liners by the things he just mentioned. By money. People separate. Now, if you had the right kind of money, you'd be on the nice decks, and if you were poor and didn't have much money, you'd be in the steerage section. If you had the wrong religion, you'd be in the steerage section, right? So it started out in the steerage section. Down in there, it was dirty and it was noisy. They probably had a cheese sandwich or something at night, and they lived in a dormitory, read old newspapers they had left over. And as you came up the deck, if you came up deck to deck, as you got, you know, more classier, things got better. When you got on the uppermost decks where all the finery was, you had the right religion, you had the right money, old money, you know. Everything, right social background. And so that's where the people up there at the cabin, in this huge dining room, they had one very big table, large table, where all the classy people sat with the captain.
They had to have the right money.
Yeah.
The right religion.
That's right.
The right ethnic background. The right everything. And if they were just perfect,
they could say,
then they could eat at the captain's table. Right. Special invitation.
So the guy at the captain's table should have never met the guy at the steerage section doing a journey across the ocean. They should have never met. There was no way they should have met. But I always think about the Titanic at night. This guy sitting at the captain's table, and this poor guy down here in the steerage section in his blue jeans, this bright guy probably had on his tuxedo up there eating all that fine food and everything, string music. And they hit that iceberg, right? And they both went down and jumped overboard. The guy from the captain's table and the guy from the steerage section. And when they hit that water, they had something in common. They came together because of a common problem to save their lives. And they were bound together by, not by social background, religion, or money. They were bound by a problem in their lives. They were bound with that. And that's what binds us. You know, this is why we try to keep those other things out of our rooms, because they divide us, right? And we need a thing that binds us. What binds us is a common problem. It goes on to say, and this is a powerful thing, there's a lot of healing force in our fellowship. There's a lot of therapeutic thing that happens just by associating with other people who have the same problem. There's strength, there's hope, there's support in our fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, unlike the ship's passenger, our joy at escape does not subside as we go our individual ways.
As soon as they got back to shore.
That's right.
And their disaster was over. And surely the man from the captain's table looked at the man from the steerage section and said, man, I don't belong with him.
Yeah.
And surely the man from the steerage section said, I don't feel comfortable around this high buckety muck. And they separated, went their individual ways, probably never to meet again.
Yeah. But we will always be alcoholics. The feeling of having shared a common peril is one element in the powerful cement that binds us. He's telling us now this is great, the fellowship is great, there's a lot of support, there's a lot of strength in the fellowship of alcohol, and it is. It's a powerful, a lot of unseen therapy that goes on just from being with each other. But he says, but that in itself would never have held us as we are now joined. The fellowship, going to the meetings, the stuff that goes between us, that's just one element of this cement. There's another element. Right? He goes on to say that would have not held us as we are now joined. You know, we just can't become, people think, you can't become a sober.
Recovered.
You can become a sober, but a recovered member of Alcoholics Anonymous just by going to AA meetings alone. We tell people go to 90 meetings in 90 days. That's not true. You cannot recover from going to 90 meetings in 90 days. You cannot become a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous by going to 90 meetings in 90 days. No more you can become a parent by going to a PTA meeting for 90 days. That would not make you a parent. You would have to take some other steps. Huh? So he says the tremendous fact, here's the other part of this cement. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. Not only do we have the same common problem, we have discovered the same common solution. We have a way out of which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. Not the news of the fellowship, but the news of the common solution. On page 25, he tells us,
let's don't go there yet.
Don't go there yet. You're right. I shouldn't jump ahead. But he explains to us that the common solution is a vital spiritual experience. He gives us on this page the prescription. Once you have the problem, then you can write the prescription. And he tells us right on this very page, our solution is power. If you're powerless, the solution is power. The power and support of other people in the group. And through the spiritual experience, you're going to tap into an inner resource of power. So what he's saying is, if you're powerless, the power and support of the group, and the power that you will tap into as a result of the steps, these two powers will overcome any one person's alcoholism. He defines the power here. You know? The common solution and the fellowship. And the common solution, we know, is to tap into an inner resource of strength. It will it's no contest between one individual's problem and these two powers.
I think the time we really realized this was the first time we did one of these in a formal setting. And we'd been asked to go to Lawton, Oklahoma. Just prior to that time, I'd had some health problems, and we didn't know whether we were going to get to go or not. And I remember Joe calling me and asking me if I thought we could go, and I said, "Well, Joe, we need to go. We've committed ourselves. We need to be there." And he said, "Well, let me bring my car." And he said, "I'll drive from my house to yours, and then I'll do all the rest of the driving, and you can rest." And I said, "Oh, fine, that's great." Now, Joe drives from Little Rock, Arkansas, up to my house, 225 miles away. We get in his car, and we start down the highway toward Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, you can look at us and tell that we're people that normally would not mix. There's a little difference in us. He's bald-headed, and I'm not. That's one of us. Getting closer to it all the time. Well, we drove out to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and there was a fellow out there named Tony. And Tony, don't mind me using his last name. His name is Vargas. And Tony had called and wanted to go to Lawton, Oklahoma with us. He was the guy that had sat in on our first meeting when we first started talking about the book. And we said, "Fine, meet us at the Camelot Hotel in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and leave your car there, and we'll proceed from there." So we get out there, and we pick up Tony. Now, we start from Tulsa down a Turner Turnpike to Oklahoma City. The black guy's driving. The Mexican is riding shotgun. The honky's in the back seat, sound asleep. When we get out to Lawton, Oklahoma, we're doing the big book study. We did this page, and I looked on the front row, and the whole front row was filled with Indians from the Anadarko Indian Reservation. That day, we really realized what this thing said. We are people who normally would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship which is indescribably wonderful. But be careful, because that fellowship is so great, we might begin to think that that's all we need. And Bill warns us that that's just one of the powerful elements in the cement which binds us together. But the great fact is, the news this book carries is the power of the common solution, not the power of the fellowship. And I think one of the greatest tragedies going on in the world today, and I don't care about Bosnia or any of the others, one of the greatest tragedies is we people in AA worldwide are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, hundreds and thousands of men and women work hours, trying to attract more and more alcoholics to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, when we've got thousands of them sitting around us every day dying from untreated alcoholism, because all they're doing is part of the fellowship, and they're not getting involved in the common solution. And sooner or later, those guys go back to drinking, and most of them end up dying from alcoholism. I think that's another responsibility that you and I have as older members of AA, to see that every newcomer fully understands this page. That if you are powerless, there's two powers, the power of the fellowship the power of the common solution. The power of the fellowship is not sufficient. Going to AA meetings will not bring about recovery. That comes through the common solution. Now, a good textbook will never tell you anything but what it doesn't expand on it and explain it to be sure that we understand it. And the first half of this chapter is devoted to showing us why fellowship alone is not enough. And then the last half will be devoted to the common solution. First thing let's do is let's look a little bit here about why fellowship alone is not sufficient. Let's go over to page 20. Page 20, first paragraph. You may already have asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, well, what do I have to do? It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. But before going into a detailed discussion, it may be well to summarize some points as we see them. Now, how many times people have said to us, I can take it or leave it alone. Why can't he? Why don't you drink like a gentleman or quit? That fella can't handle his liquor. Why don't you try beer and wine? Lay off the hard stuff. His willpower must be weak. He could stop if he wanted to. She's such a sweet girl, I should think he'd stop for her sake. The doctor told him that if he ever drank again, it would kill him. But there he is, all lit up again. Now, these are commonplace observations on drinkers which we hear all the time. Back of them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. We see that these expressions refer to people whose reactions are very different from ours. And we're going to look at two kinds of drinkers that these expressions would refer to. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely. If they have good reason for it, they can take it or leave it alone. Remember, we talked about them before. Yeah. They have a couple of drinks. They get a slightly tipsy, out of control, beginnings of a nauseous feeling. Alcohol's no big deal for them. They can take it or leave it alone. They have no problem with it. Those expressions would have referred to a moderate drinker. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker. He may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or the warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome and may even need medical attention. Now, this guy we refer to as the heavy or the hard drinker, and you and I see them all the time. They're the people who drink like we alcoholics drink, but they are not alcoholics. If a good enough reason presents itself to them, they'll do one or two things. They will either learn how to control their drinking, they do not have the physical allergy, or they will quit drinking entirely, they do not have the obsession of the mind. They drink like we drink through choice. And if a good enough reason presents itself, then they'll take care of that. The expressions I read in the beginning would refer to the hard drinker. But what about the real alcoholic? Now, he may start off as a moderate drinker, which many of us did. He may or not become a continuous hard drinker. Many of us stayed periodic. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink. Now, on this page, 21 and 22, we're going to see a description of the real alcoholic. And when you see one in here that fits you, would you please hold your hand up? I'd like to see how many real alcoholics we got in here. Here's the fellow who's been puzzling you, especially his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Does that match anybody in this room? It certainly matches me. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He's always more or less insanely drunk. There I go again. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day, and he frequently becomes disgustingly and even dangerously antisocial. Anybody like that in here? God, I used to just get meaner than hell. jump on them old boys, and they'd just whoop the hell out of me every time. Next time, I'd be right back at them again. Everybody holds their hand up on this one. He may be one of the finest fellas in the world, yet let him drink for a day, and he frequently becomes disgusting, even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tired at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. Anybody like that in here?
Yeah.
He is often perfectly sensible and well-balanced concerning everything except liquor, but in that respect, he is incredibly dishonest and selfish. There I go again. Now, here's one everybody holds their hands up on. He often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes,
yeah,
and has a promising career ahead of him.
Yeah.
I've never heard anybody say that, though, except we alcoholics.
I've never
heard an Al-Anon say that yet. He used his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. He's a fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around,
yeah,
yet early next morning he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. If he can afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house to be certain no one gets his entire supply away from him to throw down the waste pipe. As matters grow worse, he begins to use a combination of high-powered sedative and liquor to quiet his nerves so he can go to work. I think we finally changed that to uppers. Then comes a day when he simply cannot make it and gets drunk all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative to which to taper off. Then he begins to appear at hospitals and treatment centers, sanitariums.
Same thing,
just a new name for them today. They call them treatment centers. Now, this is by no means a comprehensive picture of the true alcoholic, or his behavior patterns vary, but this description should identify him roughly. Now, I guess today, if our government's ever spent anything right on alcoholism, perhaps it's been on education of the public to what alcoholism is and what it isn't. And because of that, many, many people are getting to us today before they have to do all these things that describe the real alcoholic. But I'll guarantee you, if you're an alcoholic, you found yourself in there somewhere. At least one of those are going to fit you. In my case, practically all of them. One in particular, if he could afford it, he may have liquor concealed all over his house. You know, 7 years after I got sober, and that's been now 19 years ago, I sold a 40-acre, 45,000 broiler chicken operation. And still, even today, sometimes, the guy that bought that, I'll meet him, and he'll just wave and grin, and he'll say, "Hey, Charlie, we have found another one." And he's referring to partially empty vodka bottles. They're behind corner posts, they're under rocks, they're in hollow trees, they're falling out of feed bins. He'd been finding them for 19 years. I saw him the other day and he said, "Hey, Charlie, we're going to tear down chicken house number 3. Come on over and let's see what we can find." Now, here's the picture. Why does he behave like this? If hundreds of experiences have shown him that one drink means another debacle with all its attendant suffering and humiliation, why is it that he takes that one drink? Why can't he stay on a water wagon? The moderate drinker can. The heavy drinker can. Why can't the alcoholic? What has become of the common sense and willpower that he still sometimes displays with respect to other matters? Perhaps there never will be a full answer to these questions. Opinions vary considerably as to why the alcoholic reacts differently from normal people. We are not sure why, once a certain point is reached, little can be done for him. We cannot answer the riddle. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. Now, these observations, the ones I just read, would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle of motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. If you ask him why he started on that last bender, the chances are he'll offer you any one of 100 alibis. Sometimes the excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them really make sense in the light of the havoc an alcoholic's drinking bout creates. They sound like the philosophy of the man who, having a headache, beats himself on the head with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache. If you draw this fallacious reasoning to the attention of an alcoholic, he will laugh it off or become irritated and refuse to talk. Once in a while, he may tell the truth. You know, strange as it may seem, there are times that we alcoholics tell the truth. Not too often, but occasionally. You know, I had a lady who was still in Al-Anon. She came to me one day, her husband still drinking. And she said, "Charlie, all he does is lie, lie, lie." She said, "How can you tell when one of you guys are lying? I said, "Lady, watch him closely. And if you see his lips moving, he's probably lying to you all right." And then I said, "Do you want me to tell you how to keep him from lying?" And she said, "Yeah, yeah." And I said, "Don't ask him those stupid questions. Hell, he don't know where he was. He don't know who he's with. He don't know why he started any more than you know. Don't ask him, and he won't lie." Well, the truth, strange to say. Now, this is the truth. The truth, strange to say, is usually he has no more idea why he took that first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses which are a satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts they really do not know why they do it. Once this malady has a real hold, they are a baffled lot. There is the obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect they are down for the count. Now here's the obsession of the mind. Remember, an obsession of the mind is an idea that overcomes all ideas to the contrary. An obsession of the mind is an idea that is so strong it can make you believe a lie. Now the great obsession for every alcoholic is someday, somehow, we're going to beat the game. Someday, somehow, we're going to find some kind of liquor we can drink and not get drunk. Someday, somehow, we're going to find some place to drink it and not get... Someday, somehow, we'll find a group of people to drink. And that obsession is so strong that it makes us believe that it's okay to take a drink. Then we take a drink, and then we end up drunk. But just before we take the first drink, we are stone cold sober. And there's something wrong in our mind that tells us it's okay to drink, when obviously it's not okay to drink. Page 24, squiggly writing.
The fact is that most alcoholics, for a reason yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring in our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a work a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. You know, this is the fact. You know, we are without defense against that first drink at certain times. You know, we have this obsession. We have this idea that overcomes all other ideas. Then the idea to get the relief, it blocks out the truth. And we make a decision. We're going to be talking about that later on tomorrow when we get into further in the book. Don't want to get tied up here, but you know, when you walk into to take a drink, you can't take a drink on the truth. You know, if we will be taking, and we can't see the truth. There's the inability to see the truth, because we can only see what the first few drinks are going to give us. We cannot really see what's going to really happen. You know, I used the other day, a few weeks ago, I used that Sunday.